Last week we had a lot of spirited discussion around you know, the state of our world and the state of the church and how the two interact and so on. So a lot of this came from a discussion on discipline and just how we have to, you know, deal with ourselves and with one another. And then also the idea of docility, of being able to be taught, and to be teachable. These were some discussions that prompted a lot of conversation among us. If we get into chapter 7 tonight, we deal here again with the social order and our living in the world among each other, and we're going to also talk a lot about in this chapter about proper reverence for parents and for other authority figures. There's even a little section in here on reverence for priests and so on. So we will get into all of that tonight as we begin. So with that in mind, would somebody like to be my reader tonight? All right, Billy, you want to do that? And just go ahead and read, if you could, please, the first part of chapter 7 there about warnings and admonitions regarding the social order. In your notes.
Oh, right here?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Warnings and admonitions.
All right there. Just read that paragraph.
Warnings and admonitions regarding the social order. Do no evil, and evil will not overtake you. Avoid wickedness, and it will turn aside from you. Sow not in the furrows of injustice, lest you harvest it sevenfold. Seek not from the Lord authority, nor from the king a palace of honor. Parade not your justice before the Lord, and before the king flaunt not your wisdom. Seek not to become a judge if you have not strength to root out crime, or you will show favor to the ruler and mar your integrity. Be guilty of no evil before the city's populace, nor disgrace yourself before the assembly. Do not plot to repeat a sin. Not even for one will you go unpunished. Say not, he will appreciate my many gifts. The Most High will accept my offerings. Be not impatient in prayers, and neglect not the giving of alms. Laugh not at an embittered man. Be mindful of him who exalts and humbles. Plot no mischief against your brother, nor against your friend and companion. Delight not in telling lie after lie, for it never results in good. Hate not laborious tasks, not farming, which was ordained by the Most High. Do not esteem yourself better than your fellows. Remember, his wrath will not delay. More and more, humble your pride. What awaits man is worms. Barter not a friend for money, nor a dear brother for the gold of Ophir. Dismiss not a sensible wife. A gracious wife is more precious than corals.
All right, now, a lot of seemingly disconnected advice here, but it's a... getting into allergy season here, huh? Trees are blooming. I'm a little bit sniffly myself. Now, in some ways, some of these proverbs are kind of standalone proverbs, but they're all basically knit together with this idea of kind of living or warnings and admonitions about the social order and about how we ought to either the attitudes that we should bring in our interactions, just living in human contact with other people. All right. Now, it says here, first of all, the first admonition for us is that we should avoid evil. Now, it says here, do no evil, and evil will not overtake you. Avoid wickedness, and it will turn aside from you. We've talked a little bit about this in previous sessions, but here we are, trying to remember that, again, if we fail to control our desires, they ultimately control us. Likewise, if we fail to, in some way, avoid a sin eventually overtakes us and begins to take a big chunk of our life and take possession of us. So notice again it talks about evil overtaking a person. Have you ever experienced this yourself, or have you ever seen it happen to other people? Where they just get into deeper and deeper into trouble. And, you know, it might start out with some innocent goofing off and behavior, but in the end, they're really deep into it, and they're hardly know how to get out of it. Any personal stories? But again, we see what begins to take place. Eventually, let me just give you an example of some of the sad things that I noticed growing, you know, with the kids growing up in, out there in far southeast where I was pastor. It starts out with just simple fun, goofing off. Maybe they're 6, 7, 8 years old, just kicking around. And some of the older boys kind of come and say, hey, you know, can you take this package and deliver it to those guys over there? You know, they start running drugs. And man, you're going to pay me $20 for that? Whoa! And they begin to get drawn into that. And maybe the next stage, a little skipping of school starts to go on. They're still in school most of the time, but they just start skipping a day here, a day there. Kind of, you know, kicking back and goofing off and, you know, running some more drugs, picking up some more cash. It begins to grow. You know the basic story, don't you? You begin to see that they can earn a lot of fast money real quick. After a while, they begin to not just run errands for these guys, but they begin to hang with that crowd. Maybe even officially join a gang. As they get a little older, they start getting sexually active. They have a baby with this woman, baby over there. They start boasting about had me a few women in my time. Got me a few kids running around, that, you know, kind of boasting that tends to go on, but they're not really fathers, but they're so they got that, and by now they've already got sexually transmitted diseases and other aspects, maybe even been diagnosed HIV positive. They started, you know, packing a gun and eventually get around to using it. They get deeper and deeper into the gang life, deeper and deeper into this type of lifestyle, and eventually there's some turf battles. Hey, the 6th Street guys are coming down here to 4th Street. Well, we can't tolerate that. This is our turf, so we need to go and defend it. Maybe when they were younger, it was a fist fight, but now come the weapons, and the bullets start to fly, and one or two of them get killed. And about 22 years old now. See what I'm saying? And it all starts out with just kind of goofing off one day, skipping school. You know, no harm, right? And it says here simply, don't do evil and evil will not overtake you. In other words, avoid. Remember that some of us have the act of contrition memorized. It says where we avoid the near occasions of sin. We avoid whatever leads us to sin. We try to stay away from areas where we're places that we know we're going to be tempted. Maybe it's a bar if we're an alcoholic, or an old neighborhood if we're in a you know, that kind of a situation where, you know, sometimes people come out of jail or they come out of a treatment program and they go right back to the neighborhood with the stuff freely available, and maybe they got nowhere else to go, but, you know, don't go back there, you know, is kind of the advice. Don't go back and start running with the boys again and think you're going to stay clean, you know. So yes, ma'am.
And my senior pope, I just saw on the news today at the University of Maryland, there's a movie called The Pirates of the Caribbean, but it's a pornography film.
Oh.
And on the campus, at the movie theater, just specifically for the campus, they're going to show this. And it's just an abomination because you're not in college for that. But
right.
That breeds an unfair, it just breeds a whole lot of lust in the minds of these young people. Because you have freshmen, juniors, seniors.
Sure.
And so that's, you know, it's like society is saying, you know, it's just totally okay,
right,
to show that. Or they were like, well, 4 years ago we showed this way off the wall one, and now we're doing it 4 years later just to see if it'll, you know, pretty much sell. Because it's an independent movie theater. It was not enough that could be said because it was independent. But that's, the way of the world. You know, you say pornography at a college campus.
Is it X-rated?
Yeah, it's X-rated Pirates of the Caribbean. It's a X-rated pornography film. Yeah, just it aired on NBC News today.
Yeah. You know, and we were talking a little bit last week. I can't remember if you were here last week. Mm-hmm. But how internet pornography really addicts some people. People really get... They really get bit by that demon.
Absolutely.
You know, starts out by looking at a few pictures. Yeah, let's see what's out there.
Right.
And then it gets deeper and deeper. And you know, it's not uncommon that you know, you talk to some of these you know, the well, I need to keep it very vague and general because, you know, as a priest, I've had discussions with people. I just want to keep it very general. But it starts out innocently, and this doesn't start innocently, but I mean, it starts out kind of what we might call ordinary soft core kind of pornography, and then it gets increasingly though. What happens with addiction? I think I tried to tell you a few weeks ago is that the nature of addiction is you need more and more of the thing to satisfy your desire. And so, not only do the pictures need to become more numerous, but they need to become more and more exotic and strange, and you know, and people kind of go down this trail, where after a while they're looking at illegal stuff, and the next thing you know, the FBI is knocking on the door, saying, okay, you know, you've been to illegal sites, we're here to arrest you, you know, and it all started out just looking at, you know, legal, but you know, immoral pictures, but it got worse and worse. And you know, usually I was reading an article on, and there's also I don't know if some of you have ever seen. There's a show on TV where they actually go out and arrest these guys that are doing child pornography and stuff. Yeah, okay, is that what it's called? I've listened to some of that too, and you hear some of these guys' stories.
Yeah.
And of course, they all claim they didn't know, blah blah blah, but. That's a lie, but but the point is that if you read some of these stories and there was an article in the paper about a year or so ago, it starts out with ordinary stuff, but they need more and more and stranger and more exotic stuff to sort of arouse their interest, and then they start seeing invitations to barely legal. Just 18 yesterday, these sorts of advertisements to kind of come into these websites, and this is what begins to ultimately lead them toward downright illegal sites where children and you know are being used, you know, basically child pornography and stuff, and it begins generally with them on the so-called legal side, and it takes them deeper and deeper into a really really dark hole. Why don't you just turn it off now? I think it's cool enough in here, right? Can you reach that? Okay.
I think one of the things with To Catch a Predator that was interesting, and I thought they did a good job, because they showed that it went across all faiths, all ages,
mm-hmm.
all occupations, right. all social strata, everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, was anyone from a Jewish youth director from Texas to, you know, an NP in the Army. And it was just...
Yeah.
Kind of amazing to me that they did. They started off, and that's when they would get caught. That was what they would say. They said, "Well, I was just curious about this site. That's why I went to it." And
yeah, and it just draws them in, and it's so. As I say, I don't know. Sometimes when people come to me and they say, "You know, I'm married. I got three kids, but I look at porn on the internet. I don't know how to stop." Mm-hmm. All I can think to say to them is. To develop kind of salutary fear, because what you do on the internet is not private. There's absolutely nothing private. We talked about that last weekend, probably the week before. But just be aware, if you send an email, it's a permanent record out there. It's not going to be erased. It can be tracked down. If you're visiting different sites and things like that, it can be traced back to you. It is not that hard. So you say, well, I use an alias, right? It's all tied back to credit cards. It's not easy. It's not hard. It's not hard to even find out what addresses these computers exist at and where the lines are coming from. It's very easy for the FBI to track things. And so I just presume that everything you do on the internet is in wide open public and anybody could find it out. Now, you might say, well, nobody will ever care about me. I'm just a nobody. But I'm just saying, some of these guys that get arrested on the internet, I mean, on this Predator show, they're nobodies too. So you see. Anyway. So I just say, hopefully no one here struggles with that, but if you do, just be aware of that. And secondly, share this information with others. You know, that nothing is private on the internet. And if we don't fear God, at least we won't fear the man. You know, and sometimes you need a little fear to keep you away from stuff. And so people say, oh, fear is unhealthy. No, there's actually some fear that's very healthy. It keeps us out of a lot of trouble. So a good, healthy fear, and it's a very saving thing. Okay. Now, I don't mean to say pathological fears and stuff are always healthy, but I'm just saying, in the end, I would recommend it. So again, it simply says here, do no evil, and evil will not overtake you, because there comes a point where people go so far down a path that they feel like they can't turn back, and they feel enslaved to the behavior, enslaved, and frequently we see this is true with addiction, and we just talked about one type of addiction, but also crime grabs a hold, and sadly, you know, many of our young men are lost in lives of crime, partly because of economic and social despair, but it often just starts out where they just start goofing off in school and stop passing tests and don't do homework. And, you know, after a while, school's like, well, I'm not, you know, all I'm doing is getting bad grades, so why hang around here? And then you're out in the streets, and then you're really into trouble, and it just goes downhill from there. And it just starts out by something that we all struggle with, a little laziness. See? And again, I don't mean to say that these young kids over in Southeast, you know, it's a lot easier not to be lazy when you have two parents, neither of whom are using crack themselves, and you know what I'm saying? So many of these kids are already in such messed up situations that it's just almost a miracle that they're in school and passing tests at all. You know, so it's pretty grim over there at Ballou High School and around there. It's pretty sad situation. So you might, you know, keep that area of the city in your prayers. I think right now the graduation rate from Ballou is about 40%. All right, so. And of those, 60% who graduate from Ballou are functionally illiterate. That's what, according to the Washington Post 3 years ago. I don't know if it's improved in the last 3 years. But that also tells you that an educational system is failing our young people, right? You just pass them along. You just write them off as hopeless. And you don't take them seriously. Well, if you don't take them seriously, they're not going to take themselves very seriously. So, and I'm not here to condemn the educational system, because as I said, the parents are part of the problem too. They're often non-existent. They're not there. I mean, you can't expect miracles from an educational system when the family's so dysfunctional that the kids are going home to God knows what. And then you expect them to show up on time the next morning and have any kind of a decent mind to do any learning at all. So, I don't know what you're going to say.
The educational system is a community system.
Yeah.
We are part of the system.
Right.
And it's easy to say the educational system, like it's this thing out here.
Yeah.
When it's really us.
Yeah. It's all of us. So.
Yeah. So, since the child is a villain.
Yeah. Right.
So, there's something else to look at, too.
Yep.
From a Christian perspective.
Mm-hmm.
How good a steward.
Right. Somebody say amen.
Amen.
Yeah. And by the way, that parable, the African proverb, I guess you'd call it. I think the original version of it is: it takes every family in the village to raise every child in the village, and somehow we've shortened it. Mm-hmm. But it's a very important concept that we somehow not simply put blame on this matter in one sector alone and say it's all the problem is all there. You really can't expect an educational system to be able to pick up all the pieces when the kids aren't even in school but 3 days a week and the parents aren't around to get them there, and it's just not functional. The whole thing is dysfunctional. So a lot to work and pray about. All right. Now, I would say that, again, we see here that evil will overtake us if we go down that road long enough. It's almost impossible to turn back. That's what this text is basically saying. Again, avoid wickedness, and it will turn aside from you. Okay, so this is the same proverb stated in a slightly more positive way. That avoid, in other words, avoid occasions of sin. And, again, this builds up in your life. Now, there's two types of habits that we can distinguish. One is simply called virtue,
which is good habit, right? And we also have something called vice, which is a bad habit. These are the two types of habits that we can have. Now, notice the word habit, though. If I just do something once and never do it again, is that a habit?
No.
Okay, so habit means repeated behavior. So repeatedly avoiding occasions of sin builds up in me and becomes virtue. I actually learn through repeated behavior and develop good habits. See? Now, bad behavior, same thing. We've all had a bad day where we've all had a day when we acted kind of out of character, but we quickly got up the next day and got ourselves together. Maybe we drank too much one night. It was strange for us. We hardly ever drink too much, but we did, and we drank a few extra drinks and we said and did something stupid or whatever. But then we get back up and we get back on the track. And so we're dealing there with a sin, but we're not at least dealing with a bad habit. We get back into virtue. See? So a habit pertains to an habitual, that is to say, an ongoing, a repeated behavior. And this is what we should really work at developing in our life, you know. And like any habit, it takes time to develop good habits, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I find it's a lot quicker to develop bad habits, but isn't that always the case, right? for example, I mean, let me just kind of use a silly example. It's not really, you don't think of it as a habit, but really it is. The capacity to play the piano or the organ, you know. Every now and then, you may or may not know this about me, but I'll go over to the church late at night and I'll pull all the stops on the organ and make the building shake and I'll play a hymn or two on the organ. It took me years to develop that habit, the capacity, you know, years of practice. And some of you play musical instruments speak foreign languages, or you know that these things take time to develop. And so what this text is also saying to us when it says avoid, it doesn't just mean, you know, it's like treat life staccato-like, but avoid kind of infers a type of a habitual behavior so that I'm consistently doing something good, I'm avoiding something bad, and so on. Okay? So that would be, you know, where we're going with this concept. All right, now, the next thing it says that we should be very careful not to acquire through injustice. It says, do not sow in the furrows of injustice, lest you harvest it sevenfold. All right? Any thoughts about what this means? Let's see if there's some wisdom in the room here. It says here, sow not in the furrows of injustice, lest you harvest it sevenfold. There's another proverb that comes from the Bible that says, sow not in the wind, for you will reap the whirlwind. Yeah, please.
Is it, keep wallowing in this injustice of you yourself having been just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. And I mean, what? Notice it sort of says, sow not in the furrows of injustice, so that when we think of grooves or furrows, they're sort of deep trenches or deep usual. In other words, We're not just talking about something which is a little hole in the ground, but a long trench that's been dug. There's a kind of a consistency, again, we're dealing with here. So the furrows of injustice is, you know, don't continue to walk in the paths of injustice. See what I mean by a furrow, right? You know what I meant by a furrow? Think of a farmer who's just plowed a field, and there's all these rows of open soil where he can put the seed. And that's what's meant by a furrow. So notice again that it's a long path, basically. And so the path is not just, you know, again, we all have days where we do something that's wrong. Maybe we drive a little recklessly because we're late and we almost have an accident, and we think, my gosh, what if I had actually had the accident? How awful I would feel. I, you know, would have almost hit that kid. Or, you know, we all, that's an injustice to drive recklessly, right? But on the other hand, it's not necessarily a furrow in the sense that that's just we had a bad day and we're going to improve and we generally drive very safely. Okay, that's not a furrow. But a furrow is where we consistently walk along a long path of injustice. And the idea here is that we've got to, again, develop virtue, which is good habit. Now, we were just talking about the problem of our kids, you know. And, again, let's all admit that the situation in a place like Ward 8, where I was over there in Southeast, there's a long path that's led to the problems that are over there. Some of those problems go back generations. There's community decisions, there's family decisions, there's all kinds of things that have contributed to a basic structure of injustice that many young people grow up in a completely dysfunctional thing. And I'm not going to just say it's one group's fault or one individual's fault. It's kind of a collective thing which we all take part in. It might be the injustice of neglect. It might be the injustice of simply giving up on some young people. It might be the injustice of sexual promiscuity. And, you know, most people don't think of that as a sin against justice, but it is. Because the child that may well be conceived, and, oh, but we're using contraceptives. Well, first of all, don't. But secondly, they're not foolproof. Hello? They fail a lot. And the child that can be conceived is conceived into a situation which is unjust for that child, where both parents aren't present, where there isn't preparation economically to really support a child, where there isn't the potential maturity that a person should have reached, you know, in order to be able to raise a child, where that child may be threatened by abortion because, well, I'm too young, so off to the abortion, or the child is threatened by poverty and structures of poverty and so on. So again, we don't often think of fornication as a sin against justice, but in fact, it is. It's not fair that a child should be born into a situation like that. We all agree? See? So, and again, these are the types of... There's local decisions, there's citywide decisions about where resources are spent in the city, what schools are in good shape, and what wards are those, and what schools are in bad shape and are just written off. See? Where is crime enforced? Well, law enforced, and where is it not? And you see the idea. There's a lot of social structures, and so these furrows of injustice that we walk down long paths that go back sometimes several administrations ago. We're not talking about one Republican or Democrat or Mayor Williams. It's all his fault, or Mayor Fenty. It's all his fault. It may go back all the way to Mayor Washington. Who knows how far back it goes? It may go back all the way back into the federal, whatever that board was that used to run the city, and all these sorts of things. But lots of decisions have added up over the years to a structure of injustice, and what we end up with are kids that are being lost. Now, it says here, therefore, don't reap, it says, sow not in the furrows of injustice, lest you harvest it sevenfold. And how many of you would agree with me that in effect what we're seeing is, with all these individual and collective citywide decisions, individual decisions, with all that injustice that's been sown, that we're reaping it sevenfold.
Yes.
You see, in many of our, you know, many parts of the city, and in many parts of our own lives and our families. So again, you go down these paths and you get a bumper crop. You get a bumper crop. And one complaint I make to God a lot is that, why, Lord, does it take so long to build something up and 20 seconds to tear it down? You know, have you ever felt that way? And I think I told you this last week. We've just about finished the back wall on the church now, and it took us about 6 weeks to get that stuff done, and it probably took them 20 minutes to paint it over back in the 70s. You know, that church, that wall was painted that way in the 40s, and it stayed that way till the 1970s, and one of the pastors, let's just paint it white. they painted white paint over the whole thing. And I'm told by some of the older parishioners, they were furious with the particular pastor, who I will not mention. and then I was told that he finally agreed to paint it red, so that it didn't look so horribly like blank white wall back there. But they really regretted the loss of that beautiful artwork. And anyway, but the point I'm simply saying is, it probably took 20 minutes to do that, and it's taken us 6 weeks to put it back, and someone could come back in 20 minutes and paint it over again. Now, that's about a wall. Who cares about a wall? But what I'm trying to show you is this symbol. We can take years and years to build up something in a parish like this or in a community. And it's amazing how quickly it can fall into decay and just fall apart if it isn't maintained. You know, I don't mean the building. I'm talking about human structures. And it's amazing. And that's one of my complaints to God. You know, it's not fair, God. It's not fair. We spend all these years building up something great, and then the wrong leader comes and the whole thing falls apart. Or, you know, in 20 minutes. You know, so anyway. Just the way life is, though, right? So we're warned here by this text. We're warned. Now, don't sow not in the furrows of injustice, lest you harvest it sevenfold. All right, is that clear enough now? Mm-hmm. Now, verses 4 through 6 here regarding authority having its dangers. Now, you know, a lot of us want to be in charge. Pay attention. Pay attention here, all right? To whom much is given, much will be expected. Don't be so quick to want to run off and be an authority. I say that as one who has some limited authority. Seek not from the Lord authority, nor from a king a place of honor. Parade not your justice before the Lord, and before a king flaunt not your wisdom. It says, seek not to become a judge if you have not the strength to root out crime, or you will show favor to the ruler and mar your integrity. So again, be careful of these positions of judge, of teacher, of pastor, of supervisor at work. Be careful. Be careful, because, and I guess it doesn't say don't ever take them. It just says, just don't thirst after, don't seek after these things. If they come to you, accept them with humility. But man, if you're looking for position and power, you are cruising for a bruising. You are setting yourself up for endless possible situations of sin. And it gives you some examples here, right? First of all, it says don't seek authority. Seek not from the Lord authority. Again, I'm telling you, you got decisions to make when you're in authority, and you're going to get hung up for some of them. And some of them, again, remember, to whom much is given, much is expected. So the Bible says that kings and rulers will have to render an account to God for what they've done. You know, we think, oh, look what they get away with. They're not getting away with anything, whoever they are. Oh, look at this. They're going to render an account. And they're going to have one of the hardest accounts to render of all. See, so don't. If you're seeking these things of honor, be careful. Be careful. Not everything is as it appears. It says here, don't before the king, don't flaunt your wisdom. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed a line there. Don't seek a place of honor from a king. Okay. Now it goes on to say here, parade not your justice before the Lord. And before a king, flaunt not your wisdom. A somewhat of a difficult text, but the idea, first of all, it's a lot easier, I think, to understand about the Lord, because most of us don't understand about kings very much, but the Lord, flaunt not your justice before the Lord. Remember the Lord told the parable about the two men who went to pray? One was a sinner, or a publican, or a tax collector, and the other was a Pharisee. You know, the Pharisee said, I thank you, Lord, that I am not like the rest of men, grasping, crooked, even like this man over here. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes on all I own. You know. And of course, the other man beat his breast and said, have mercy on me, a sinner. And the Lord said, I want you to know who went away justified that day. Right? Not the man who flaunted his justice. Look at me, you know. I mean, when you think about it, it's pretty silly. It's a silly story, isn't it? I mean, it's so extreme. But, you know, we the Lord is telling us, and, you know, sometimes we don't think of Jesus as having a sense of humor or telling jokes a lot. But some of these parables are really pretty funny, you know. They really are. You're supposed to kind of have a good belly laugh about some of them. They're funny stories. You know, you go, I fast twice. You can see the guy in the temple there. Look at me, Lord. And that's where you're supposed to laugh. You see, the story about the guy with a 2x4 coming out of his eye. And he says, pardon me, sir, you have a speck in your eye? Pardon me, I'm hitting with my 2x4. Let me take that speck out of your eye. You know, I mean, you know, you're supposed to laugh. It's silly. I mean, we're very funny to God. I think we must be very funny to God sometimes. He must really laugh at us sometimes. That we elevate ourselves and we puff up and we think we're so important and special, and I mean, yes. God's just having a good laugh, you know. He's just having a good laugh. So, anyway, the point is don't parade your justice before God, because first of all, if you have any justice, God gave it to you. It's his gift to you. It's not your gift to him. And you can't say, God, you owe me because I did something, because God did it. You didn't do it. If you have any good deeds at all, they're his work in you. They're not your work for him. Okay? See the idea? So don't do it. It's just silly. It's just kind of dopey. Not very bright. And God said, well, I can see God almost saying, man, some people are just too stupid to go to hell. I'm going to have to let this one in. I mean, a little silly, but I mean, the point is that we're supposed to kind of laugh at this stuff a little. You see what I'm saying? All right. Seek not from the Lord authority, nor from the king. Okay, parade not your justice before the Lord, and before a king flaunt not your wisdom. Now, the only point here is, most of you may know this, kings of old had a whole court of officials who advised them. These were not uninformed men, these kings, is my point. You're probably going to look pretty foolish if you come before the king and say, I want to tell you something you probably don't know. You know. You see, remember, even Moses encountered this a little bit, and it's a very strange story for us, but he went before Pharaoh, and he worked a few miracles, and Pharaoh brought in his magicians, and they worked the same miracles. Now, you might say, how is this possible? You know, but again, unfortunately, God has allowed the devil to have some power, too. See, and so Pharaoh wasn't real impressed with Moses at first. Now, of course, eventually, you know the whole story. I don't mean to give the whole story of Moses, but the idea of being able to flaunt your wisdom before a king is that, again, you're probably going to end up looking pretty stupid, because the king probably, A, already knows it, and B, has three other advisors who have a different opinion anyway. You know, and so the point is simply that wait till you're asked. Have a certain humility. Don't boast of your knowledge before people who have lots of advisors already. Just be careful with that, okay? And that would be kind of the advice. And again, fundamentally, it's an appeal to humility, isn't it? See. All right. Now, moving on, about admiration, verse 7. Be guilty of... I'm sorry, we've missed the one about a judge, which is very important. Seek not to become a judge if you don't have the strength to root out crime. All right, did you hear that? Could I change that for a minute? Seek not to become a parent if you have not the strength to punish your child. Okay, now, you may say, well, that's pretty negative, Father. All you do is punish your child. I didn't say that, but I'm just saying that if you're a parent, you need a lot of strength to discipline a child. Because, again, we're all born into this world with original sin, you know. And your lovely little child was born with original sin like the rest of us. And, most of you have been through the terrible twos, and you know it takes a lot of stamina to be a parent, doesn't it? Now, the same thing is sort of being said here about a judge. You know, if you're going to be a judge, you got to realize you're going to be dealing with some real tough situations that are going to require you to make decisions that you'd rather not make, issue punishments, accept the fact that not everyone's going to be happy with your judgments. And also you're going to face a very strong temptation to being bribed. And not all bribery comes in the form of money. Sometimes there's just a lot of social pressure on the judge to rule in a certain direction. You know, if a community is particularly outraged about some particular kind of crime or some particular class of people, the judge can be swayed. It may not be about money, but it's about popularity, it's about power, it's about being liked. So, you know, some of us in the room, have been before courts before, and we've seen that sometimes judges seem to alight to certain types of defendants and others not. And another example... and many African Americans didn't feel they got a fair shake in court, and there were already prejudices and presumptions made about, so I'm just saying, you got to be careful that the text is saying if you're a judge. But since most of us aren't judges, I think one of us in here works for a judge. In the end, I might say that all of us are in situations, though, where sometimes we have to be in the position of being a judge or being in authority. And most of you are parents and grandparents, and I'm just saying, you know, if you don't want to deal with having to discipline children, don't have them. You know, But you gotta, and again, kids are great at pushing buttons and knowing how to push back and say, but Mom, you're being unreasonable. All my other friends. It takes a lot of strength, doesn't it? All right, I see some nods. So, and unfortunately today, some parents today have become less inclined to want to discipline and insist on good behavior. That's just my opinion, but I see that I say that from my long experience of having worked with Catholic schools now for over 20 years, and until this last year, I've always had a Catholic school that I walked the halls and I met the kids. And sometimes the parents were worse than the kids. And I don't mean this is always a ubiquitous problem. I'm just saying individual cases. And there were increasing problems in disciplining the children over the last 20 years. I think, you know, in more recent years, it's become even more difficult. And a lot of times because the parents don't back it up, you know, the discipline, and a lot of problems. So, again, I would just say, let's be careful here to realize that in life, sometimes we have to do things that are unpleasant if we have any authority at all, whether we're just the supervisor at work, and we have to reward and punish certain behaviors, make decisions that won't always be popular, whether you're a pastor of a church, you make decisions that not everybody agrees with, or they don't like your priorities, or sometimes you're a father or a mother, and your kids are going to push back and protest, and, you know, You got to be strong. You got to learn leadership. And I'm afraid personally today that I think leadership is becoming harder and harder to find because people just aren't willing to take the heat. And so they easily give in and they're not really leading anymore. They're just saying, well, what do we want to do? And sometimes in life you just need leadership. There can be work situations where maybe being really collaborative works well. But in the family, children need to be led. So you've heard me say this before, and I'll say it again, I'm sure. Parents, command your children. If you do not command them, somebody else will. But they've got to learn from somebody and have firm, clear guidance, leadership. No one will follow an uncertain trumpet. And so this is the sort of stuff if you want authority, and most of us do want some authority, be willing to lead and be willing to take the heat. And not everybody is. And because of it, they're not good leaders. So, okay. Comments or questions on that? Yep. We certainly learn. And ideally, we learn as children what it is to be a good parent, and then we're a good parent. Or, like you say, at work maybe, or other places. So, yes, I would agree.
In order to train the kid, the child, you have to get your instructions from something. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But you have, you know, this goes right back to what you were saying in the beginning, because you still have kids who are brought up in two family homes, and
mm-hmm.
you know they're made to go to church on Sundays and Sunday school and CBD
right.
classes, and yet when they're picked up by the police, they still test positive PCP and
yeah.
marijuana and all this other stuff.
Right.
I mean, you know, we're outgunned.
Yeah,
when the kid walks out the door, you know, we can't follow him around. Constantly. Me and my wife talk about that all the time. How and I use myself as a classic example. When you were talking about personal story, you know, I don't like it. But I did this, you know, my parents brought me up in the same way. You know, I was in Catholic school, but as soon as I got out the door, it was what I wanted to do. You know, but I'm one of the success stories who survived. Being uh-huh. shot at and all that other stuff. Everybody don't survive that, you know.
Right.
And it's not because they weren't brought up in the environment to know right from wrong. But basically, what it is just exercising proper judgment.
Yes.
You know, and it's hard. It's hard as us as parents today because you read about so many parents, and I'm sure the young lady can tell you so many parents who are brought up on charges for disciplining the kids.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy, you know.
Pretty hard to be a parent today.
You can't lock your kid in the house. They're going to climb out a window. You know what I'm saying? Or they call the police to tell them you locked them in the house and you're arrested for it's all kind of stuff that's going on there. So, you know, what do you do?
Courage. I don't know. I know that there can be some of these situations that come up, but it takes an incredible amount of courage and self-will today to do these things. And to really fight the good fight. I know that both my brothers made a decision pretty early in their family's career, family's life, that they weren't going to have TV in their house. They just weren't going to have that stuff. Now, they have TV but that's hooked to a DVD. It's not hooked to some cable where you can get. But they just will not allow their children to be influenced by all that garbage. And there's too much garbage. And you say, well, there's a few good things. I know. And that's what you got the DVD for. But, and that takes a lot of, well, I'm going to miss a few shows that I like. You know, we have to sometimes make these trade-offs and say, well, I'm okay, but my kid, you know, and sometimes it's just going to take, it takes real creativity and real insistence. And I don't know what, I don't have a simple answer for you except to say resolve, courage. We've got to redouble our efforts today because, as you say, there's so many other influences that never existed when some of the people in this room were children. You know, I certainly had, I grew up with TV, certainly, but I didn't have internet and other things like that. And anyway, the point simply being is that we've just got to be absolutely more vigilant than ever. And but we also have to, I think, relearn some old lessons of the past, if I can just maybe add. Remember, some of you are probably old enough to remember that parents actually used to chaperone. Yeah. You know, why are we so confused that we think that we can have co-ed dorms in our college campuses and not expect an explosion of STDs and pregnancies? What are we thinking? We need to get common sense back a little bit, too, and start to say we've got to police young people, and but we also need to be really more on the scene with them and not just presume that they can just go off on their own and do so many things on their own. In the old days, I think most of us were used to, we didn't even have a car until we were graduated from high school. I mean, the idea, I never owned a car until I was 18, and the idea of having a car when I was 15, I wasn't ready for that. But anyway, the point is that, you know, and dates and things like that were chaperoned, and proms and things were more, you know, it just wasn't as free-for-all as it is today. And so I think part of it is redoubling our efforts, but part of it's also just relearning some old lessons that we've set aside. And it's going to require more work. And some, again, part of it's just plain old laziness. We just don't want to do it. It's just too much work to keep an eye on our kids and watch what they're watching, keep an eye on their internet activity, and it's just a lot of work. And parents are working, and you got both parents working, and it's just, we're worn out. And so these are the sorts of things that I think we just have to sometimes take a step back and say, you know, what's really most important in my life? You know, is it that we have the house with the cathedral ceilings and the matching SUVs and the three-car garage? Or is it to live in a smaller house where we don't have to work three jobs to afford the house with the cathedral ceilings, and that way I can actually, you know, get to know my kids? I mean, what's really important to us? I mean, what are my priorities? What are my values? Do we really need a double income? Maybe one of us can stay home and really raise these kids, you know? If it's that important, you find the times and the ways to do it. And part of the problem is it isn't that important to us. We want to have it all. We want to have the big house and the flat screen TV and God knows what else. And you can't have it all. You got to make decisions. And I know a family, I won't mention, I won't embarrass them, but probably a family that you know, but they've made some decisions to take smaller incomes so they could really be with their kids. And they could go out and make a killing, do the six-figure thing, but they might lose their kids in the process. Mm-hmm. So they've made decisions to have jobs that are more reasonable in their hours, and they can stay closer to home and actually raise their kids, believe it or not, just actually raise their kids. Both my brothers, again, if they could be in the earning six figures if their wives would go out and work, but they say no. They rather live in a smaller house and have fewer things, and actually have their wives be able to be full time mothers. And so, and again, the wives agree to that. But again, it's we just have to sometimes be willing to make decisions that take away some of our fun and take away some of our toys, and we may not be able to afford everything. You can't have it all, which is basically what the world is trying to tell us today. You have to make decisions and trade-offs.
Coming back to, when I was little, one of my relatives said, you need to get back to Genesis. And I think, from the reflection what they were saying, family is everything.
Mm-hmm.
Heritage is everything.
Yes.
So when you make the decision that when we say children are important, then they should be preeminent. And all of your structures, all of your organizations, all of that should feed into the nurturing of human beings. And I think we have become more selfish, very polarizing in the workplace. Single parents are juxtaposed against two-parent households or parentless individuals. Why can't you dedicate more time in the office? And people play a lot of power games. There's a lot of labeling. And to be honest with you, I don't really think that parenthood is revered.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I have to say this. I don't really think that being a parent is revered. It's not a title that's thought of as being empowering.
You know, a priest friend of mine wrote an article some years ago in the Catholic Standard, and I, as usual, I meant to clip it out and keep it. I'm terrible about these things. But anyway, his basic point was that if you were to ask the average person today, what's marriage for? Most people say, for happiness. For basically, most of the answers revolve around the couple. And this, by the way, is one of the reasons why a lot of people think that we ought to just be able to interchange marriage for whatever definition we want. Because it's all about the adults. It's about two people being happy. So why can't two gay people be happy? Why can't, you know, it's all about the two adults being happy. And if they're not happy anymore, then they should be able to get divorced. If they're not happy, it's all about two adults being happy. Now, unfortunately, that is not really the traditional understanding of marriage. Marriage is really about children. And that's why it's structured the way it is, and why it should be a permanent fixed arrangement of stable commitment because of the children and for the children's sake and for the fact that children need to be raised in this kind of an environment. So in a kind of a different way, a different angle, but saying the same thing that you're saying, which is that we sometimes, as much as we like to talk about, what about the children? I mean, and that's a beautiful song, by the way, don't we? But the more we sing that, the less I'm convinced it really is about the children. And it's more about really the adults and what the adults want. And so a pastor who's a Baptist minister, I remember one time he was talking to a couple. And he said, well, we're going to get a divorce because we're bickering all the time. And we don't want our children to grow up in a home where there's all this bickering. And he said, well, why don't you stop the bickering? You know, usually when they say, well, we're getting divorced for the sake of the children, I'm not convinced. But anyway, again, we could go on about these things, but just, my gosh, it's it all got started when we started talking about authority and raising kids and all. But see, here we are again. Remember, we're catechumens, and we come into the church from a world gone mad. Right? And the church says, man, you're so screwed up, we're going to need 3 years to work with you. So they have a 3-year catechumenate. Because, you know, the world is so crazy and we're so messed up by it, stinking thinking, that we kind of come in almost on autopilot, not even thinking about a lot of this stuff. And look at just what a few lines do. You can see why it took them 3 years to get through something like this, right? See what I'm saying? Because people in the year 250 AD had the same kind of discussions we're having now. And it takes a long time to kind of get our brain cleaned out from some of the world's ways and the world's priorities and the world's thinking. A lot of repetition and, you know, going over the same stuff. So, here we go on. Let's move on to the question of admiration in verse 7. Be guilty of no evil before the city's populace, nor disgrace yourself before the assembly. Now, this may sound like a somewhat egocentric reason to avoid sin, but I'll be honest with it, I use it. Don't you? I'm not going to sin because I don't want to be disgraced in front of people. I mean, I'm hoping it's not the only thing that keeps me out of trouble as a priest, but one of the things that keeps me out of trouble is that I couldn't bear the thought of you seeing me being taken away in handcuffs somewhere. I just love you too much to ever burden you with that kind of a thing. So part of, and also just maybe a little bit of my own ego. I don't want to be thought of, what's that?
You don't want to be a hypocrite.
Well, that's true. That too. But I'm hoping there's other reasons. I'm not saying there aren't other reasons. But I'm saying one of the reasons is that I simply don't want to disgrace the priesthood. I don't want to disgrace myself. I do want to be, generally speaking, admired for good behavior. I mean, that's, now, I'm just being honest with you. But honestly, the text is basically saying this is an adequate thing. It's fairly egocentric. Do well because you don't want people to, you know, be hurt or scandalized at your bad behavior, and you want to be well thought of. But egocentric though it may be, hey, any motive will do if it's going to help me to do the right thing. And hopefully it's not someone's only motive, is my only point, right? But we all have a little bit of ego in everything we do, right? And I would hope that some of you would have some of this going on too, that part of what keeps you behaving well is that you don't want to disgrace your family, or you don't want to be disgraced before your children. You know, you want to just be well regarded. It's part of life. I think it's as good a reason to avoid sin. I don't say it's as good a reason as any, but it's certainly, I think, one reason. And, you know, hey, if you can use a little vanity to your own advantage, why not, you know? So, again, take it for what it's worth. It's maybe not the best motive to avoid sin, but sometimes if that's all you got, go with it, right? Yeah. Sometimes all we have is fear of punishment. That's all you got. I feel like it's okay, but I won't do it because I don't want to get caught. So, hey, use it, man. Use it. Now, hopefully, over time, you'll begin to see that not only am I afraid of, I'm not so much afraid of being punished, I just don't want to offend God because I've come to see that God doesn't want me to behave this or that way or do this or that. But sometimes it's you're waiting for more perfect motives to come along. Lower motives will work. Okay? Right? Now, I mean, and this is part of the growing. I mean, when I was a kid, it was almost always fear of punishment that kept me from getting in trouble. I had almost no other motive. but as I grew older and my mind began to reflect and I began to think on what was right and good and true and beautiful, then I began to have other richer motives to avoid bad behavior. And I would say now, after 47 years of trying to live the Christian faith, at least for the last 25 years, that I can say that more and more my motives are really that I'm on board with God. I really think that things are wrong, and it makes sense to me why God forbids certain things and why His advice makes sense. You know, so it's not just fear of punishment that keeps me out of trouble, although that's still there, a little bit. Yeah. All right. Moving on about assumptions here. Do not plot to repeat a sin. Not even for one will you go unpunished. Say not, He, namely God, will appreciate my many gifts. The Most High will accept my offerings. Again, are you starting to laugh again? The idea of the sin of presumption is we just figure I can just keep going on sinning and God won't punish me. And God's, and the text is simply saying, every one of your sins God will require of you. Whoa. See? And again, just another reason not to immediately declare that someone's zing in heaven as soon as they die. Their pulses hardly stop, and we're already saying they're in heaven. Just be a little more reverential about death and about judgment than that, okay? I'm just saying. Jesus, I think, is teaching on purgatory when he says that settle with your opponent, namely your own conscience, on the way to court, because otherwise your opponent's going to hand you over to the judge, and the judge is going to hand you over to the jailer, and I promise you, you won't be released until you've paid the last penny. Mm-hmm. Now, there is release from this prison, so it's not hell that he's talking about. Again, you'll be released after you've paid the last penny. But the point is that I've tried to explain to you before about reparation and why our sins need to be, why God needs to adjudicate all of our sins. And I've tried to show it to you this way. I'm standing here right now, and you say, please take three steps to the right. And I say, uh-uh. I don't like being told what to do. And I take three steps to the left. Now, I'm sorry. I think I made a mistake here. Would you please forgive me? And you say, yes. Only problem is, I now need to take six steps to my right. To get. Now, I'm presuming now for a minute that you are God, and you didn't ask me to come over here just for some arbitrary reason. You really needed me over there. So I still have a journey to make, don't I? You've forgiven me. Thank you, Lord. Now, start walking. And that's what I think God means when he says we have to pay back the last penny. That is to say that whenever we indulge in sin and so on, we are lacking something that we need. And it takes a while to build it back up. Like I said, it takes years to build something up and 20 minutes to tear it down. Just be careful. Just be careful. This text is basically saying that it's not that God is just saying, I'm going to punish you for everything you've ever done. I need to vent my anger against you. I'm going to punish you. You know, that's we do that. That's human. God is not just trying to punish us. God is trying to get us to where we need to be so that we'll be holy and happy. Are you praying with me? God is not just venting his anger. All right. So the idea of him punishing us, it says here in this text, do not plot to repeat a sin, for even one will you go unpunished. It's not just God's going to get you, you know, just like that. But it's God, you're getting further off from where you need to be, and you're adding sin upon sin, and you're getting further and further and further away from where you need to be, and it's going to... God's gonna get you back. And if you die over here in this condition, and let's say you're not in bad enough shape to go to hell, God still has to heal all the effects of your sin. Now, I don't know after death whether it happens quickly or whether it takes time. I don't even know if there is time after I die, as we understand it. I don't know. But I'm just saying, when somebody dies, pray. The Bible doesn't say you go straight to heaven. The Bible says you go straight to judgment. And after that, none of your business. Mm-hmm. That's to say, in other words, when you send a loved one to God, you send them to judgment. That much we know. Mm-hmm. After that, that's between them and God. Now, we can have confidence that a person is in hell if they were a person of faith. Amen to that. Mm-hmm. But at least pray. Mm-hmm. Because if they need some tears wiped from their eyes, if they need some things explained, if they need some rough edges from their personality smoothed out, if any of you were to die today, are you really perfect if the Heavenly Father's perfect? Well, God said you got to be that way to get to heaven. The Bible says in the book of Revelation, nothing imperfect will enter there. All I know is if I die today, the Lord had to finish a few things off. Okay? And He will do it because He's merciful. But He will do it. Are you praying? He will do it. It's not just a wave of the hand. There is something that actually has to happen to us. And all I know is that God will... So whenever a loved one dies, I give them to God and I pray for them. I still say masses for the repose of my parents' soul. I don't know the relationship between the time I'm living in and eternity. Do you?
No.
Okay. So just remember them in prayer. That's all. That's what this text is saying. And we're going to read that in a minute here too. Well, maybe not in a minute. We may not get to that text tonight. But anyway, it goes on to say here, don't add sin upon sin, in other words. You're going to get punished for them all. So don't add it up. Now, punished again, understood as I explained it to you, right? Not just God bending his anger and whooping you. Mm-hmm. All right, like we do sometimes, sadly. Say, now, you will appreciate my many gifts. In other words, don't think that you're going to buy your way out of the punishments by just, you know, I'll do a few nice things. I'll throw a few coins in the poor box. Now, the Bible does say that paying alms is one way to atone for sins, but don't think you're going to buy your way out of it, okay? Yes?
How does this fit into, like, this discussion about faith and works?
I don't know. Can you answer your question? Okay, well, works... I'm just trying to think. Maybe I was asking you to clarify your question, but I think what I hear you saying is,
you know, you talk about how you can't separate, you know, flame and heat. Mm-hmm. And here it seems like, you know, you want, it's just, you know, you're not repeating the sin.
It says you are repeating it.
Well, yeah, but it's like you're trying to buy it off. So it's like doing good work, mm-hmm. and staying long with the person.
Yeah. No, well, you remember, your good works are not your work anyway. You can't buy God off with God's own money. Does that make sense? So, again, the point is, stop sinning. Stop. You know, you remember the old expression, you know, rule number one about holes? You know, when you're digging a hole, rule number one? What's rule number one when you're digging a hole? You're getting deeper and deeper. Huh? Just stop digging, is the point. You see what I'm saying? You're digging a hole and you're getting deeper and deeper. What, rule number one, stop digging. Okay. All right. I thought that was a pretty commonly known expression. Okay. Rule number one about holes, stop digging. Okay. All right. Okay, then, let's move on. Regarding alms and prayers, though, it does say this, to be not impatient in prayers, and neglect not the giving of alms. Impatient in prayers. Okay, how long is this mass going to be? Let's see now. I've told God that I'm going to pray for 10 minutes. Let me... All right. you get the point, right? Okay. And remember to give alms to the poor. Now, notice the connection between prayer and giving of alms. Again, and Jesus does the same thing. He connects the life of true faith and true prayer and true love of God with love of the poor and the giving of alms and so on. So just be aware of the connection. I don't have time to develop it all now, but the bottom line is that when you really say, if you really love God, one of the great objects of God's love isn't an object at all. It's a person, namely the poor. Okay? So if you really love God, and it's a real love, and you really have God's love in you, you're going to love the poor, and you're going to be generous. Now, I know you can't give away all your money. I know you've got to make some decisions, and some are worthy of receiving alms, and some probably are not, and we have to make some... I understand all that stuff. I'm just holding all that equal for now. But the bottom line is that when you really love God, you love the people that He loves. And one of the great apples of God's eye are the poor. Okay? So that's the connection between true prayer, which is worship of God and an experience of God's love, and the giving of alms. All right, moving on. Advert to God. That's a turn to God, which is what I mean by advert there. So, verse 11, it says, laugh not at an embittered man. Now, what does that have to do with turning to God? Well, let's read on. Laugh not at an embittered man. Be mindful of him who exalts and humbles. So, now, the idea of an embittered man is, I read my commentary, maybe some of you have your commentaries open. The word embittered here doesn't mean it like we often mean, namely a person who's just, they've indulged in anger and resentfulness for so long that they're just bitter. Now, it's not a good idea to laugh at that kind of a person either, but embittered here means more someone who's really struck down with suffering. It means it in a less hostile way than we tend to use the word embittered, okay? I don't know if any of you have any footnotes on this. Any of you, and you're open, if you have a Bible open, does it say anything on that verse?
It just says,
okay, nothing about it?
No, it says 7 and 11. Him who exalts and humbles.
Yeah, God.
God, and then it says...
Yeah, okay. Well, it doesn't mention the word embittered. But again, the bottom line is don't laugh at the misfortunes of other people. Did you get the point?
You're not the downtrodden.
Yeah, the downtrodden. Don't laugh at other people's misfortune or their downtrodden status. Yeah.
It does say mischief and deceit toward one's neighbor.
Okay.
That's the next verse.
That's the next verse, I think, yeah. But anyway, all right, so we'll... We'll leave it at that, but you see the idea. Don't laugh at these things. Now, well, first of all, the cruelty of it. Yeah. But secondly, remember, the idea here is, and here is a very important expression that we need to teach our young people again. And this is lurking in every one of these verses. Are you watching here? God is watching.
Yeah.
I used to walk the halls of the school. And those kids would be joning on each other. One kid trips and falls, and all the kids are laughing. I come up to them and I say, God is watching. They look around. But you know, we don't live in a culture that reminds us of God's presence much. Now, if you were to go back into the Middle Ages, for example, you'd go back into an enchanted world where people were always... It was, and almost, you know, to a fault, they were almost, you know, superstitious about things. But angels and demons were lurking everywhere. The world was enchanted. It had angels and demons at work, and God saw everything, and everything was about God. And almost to, again, a superstitious quality. And we've gone to the other extreme, where God is almost never... It is possible for people to go through their day and hear nothing of God for days at a time. And hardly think of God. To have nothing to remind them of God. Almost nothing. Remarkable. I mean, how secularized, you know, the Western world has become. Whereas, again, if you were to go back, you know, hundreds of years ago, even just go back to the founding of this country, you know, the founders of this country thought
nothing of just mentioning God in the opening lines of the Declaration, and just God was ever present. How do I know that I have rights? Because God gave them. And they're inalienable because God gave them. Well, that was an argument that people said, okay. And people said, well, how do I know there's a God? That's what we say today, and how do I know? And we have to go through all that, but the founding fathers were actually able to say, now look, certain rights are given by God, and no one can take them away. Life, liberty, God gave these rights, and everyone basically said, yeah, you're right. And instead of this, well, how do I know there's God? See, that's our modern problem. See, we become that. And I'm not saying that the founding fathers were all very pious and men in church every Sunday either. Some of them weren't. But they all had the sense that God existed and that God is watching. That we better darn well measure up to some of God's standards. And that was an argument that people accepted. Now today, not so. Well, that's your private opinion. Now, advert to God. So it says here, again, don't laugh at an embittered man. Be mindful of him who exalts and humbles. Namely, remember, God is watching. Plot no mischief against your brother, nor against your friend as a companion. And don't delight in telling lie after lie, for it never results in good. Hate not laborious. Okay, that goes on to another thing. But again, just watch out, man. God is watching. God is listening. God sees all. And it simply says regarding lying, it never leads to any good. It's the truth that sets us free. Okay, so. All right. Now, moving on to try to get past this section, we see here we move on to a slightly different aspect here regarding what do you admire? You see, you know, what we do, we sort out and we exalt certain professions, certain occupations. Ooh, the doctor is up there and the ditch digger's down there. And, you know, we do that. See, we sort people out like this, you see. But I promise you, the ditch digger's doing something pretty important for all of us, you see. But again, what's that?
Keeping the doctor employed.
Yeah, there you go. Right. I had a secretary, Yolanda, and she used to be so sick, and she went through so many different surgeries, and she says, I have put both my doctor's kids through college. All right. Now, it says here, don't hate laborious tasks, nor farming, which was ordained by the Most High God. Now, even in those days, they tended down in Jerusalem to regard the folks up in Galilee as a bunch of hayseeds, a bunch of farmers. And I think I told you, they had a hick accent up there in Galilee. You know that, don't you? And they had an accent. And the people in Jerusalem, we are a university town. We know all scriptures. You know, and they looked down at people from Galilee because they were farmers, they were vineyard owners, or dressed, you know, they dressed vineyards, they herded sheep and cattle. You know, farmers. And Jesus grew up, you know, see how humble Jesus was? He grew up in the hick country. And he and Mary had a hick accent. Amen, amen, I say to you. I mean, I wish you'd do this, but I mean, you know what I'm saying. We just have to sort of enter into the humility of God, right? And this text is saying, man, don't look down. Don't look down at this kind of stuff, especially when you sit down to your meal. Remember the farmers who worked and toiled that you could do it. You know, a lot of these farmers get up at 4 in the morning, you know, and stuff like that. So, you know, and we're sleeping in till 6. Luxuriating. All right. So, anyway, the point is that, you know, again, have a certain sense of how interrelated we really all are. You know, don't size up people simply by their work or their job and say that this is good and that's nothing. And unfortunately, we're always going to have these added. We can't completely avoid them. And we don't pay ditch diggers like we pay doctors. And I understand why. But in the end, we have to be a little bit more equanimous. We need to be more equal in how we see every human person and their dignity. Okay? All right, now, do not esteem yourself better than your fellows. Remember, his wrath will not delay. All right? So, I think I told you this little parable before. Let's say that I start to think pretty well of myself. You know, I'm older than you. Well, let me just tell you a little parable. Let's say that we are on our way to we're on our way to some, I don't know, very
exciting talk or some event, and on the way I boast that I have $50 in my pocket and you've only got five. I've got 10 times as much money in my pocket as you do. $50 compared to your $5. Look at me, man. I've 10 times as much money as you have. All right, got the idea? Now we get to the lecture hall or whatever. We find out that the price of admission is $50 trillion. Now that's some inflation there, right? All right. But you see, the point I'm trying to make is that, do you understand how holy God is? And for me to suggest that I've got even 10 times as much holiness as you is like 10 times some infinitesimally small number compared to God's holiness. And all I know is that we're all going to need lots of grace and mercy to get into the talk. I've got $50, you've got $5. Even if we put both our money together, we're not even close. All right? Are you praying? It's $50 trillion to get in the door. We're going to need a lot of mercy. All of it. Even with me having 10 times as much as you, it's not even close. I need mercy down here. And grace in abundance. So, in the end, the idea is don't... remember this now. It says here, you know, remember who you are. Don't esteem yourself better than your fellows. Okay. Just remember, God's wrath can easily alight on any of us. None of us measure up. None of us measure up to what we ought to be. All right. More and more humble your pride. What awaits man is worms. Do I need to elaborate? Okay. So, again, the rich man, the poor man, the exalted man, the ruler, the peasant, worms. Okay?
You're thinking right. About women.
Uh-oh.
All right. We already knew that.
Thank you.
All right.
Where is inclusive language when I need it? All right. All right. Then, again, assigning proper value to things. Barter not a friend for money, nor a dear brother for the gold of Ophir. You know, what's more important? You know, we talked about this earlier. Our money, our possessions, our big fancy house, or our children. What's more important? You know? And yet, how often do we sell off our kids? I'm not saying everybody here in the room. You know what I'm saying, but I say we, right? But too often we, the human family, are willing to sort of sacrifice our children on the altar of convenience, of wealth, of the big fancy house. And it's just sad. Don't sell, barter not a friend for money. You know, it's only money. But a friend is limitless in value. See? A child, limitless, you see? Or dear brother, for the gold of Ophir. Now that was the finest gold they knew. The finest, the 24 karat gold. You know, the finest gold came from Ophir. The mines at Ophir. Even for that kind of a gold, never, never sell out a brother. See? It's just not worth it. The brother is worth more. Dismiss not a sensible wife. A gracious wife is more precious than corals. See? Now again, unfortunately in that culture, divorce was, one of the options that men would exercise. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know what I mean by using that expression, but many of the men of that day, even if they had a good, sensible wife, they were not so much unlike men as sometimes of today. Well, that one over there is prettier, and she's thinner, and, you know, whatever, and she's, and my old wife's driving me crazy. I mean, well, it says here, but she's a good wife, a sensible wife, a good homemaker. She loves the kids, you know. Don't dismiss her. See the idea? You can run after the honey. And that's lust. But a good... And we're going to see more of this, by the way, in the book of Sirach as we get on. It's going to be very unpolitically correct, some of the stuff that's said. But it basically cautions a young man very carefully to be very careful that the physical beauty of a woman may be very appealing. But there's more to be considered. All right? We need to see more than just the physical beauty of a woman. And we need to understand that, again, a good, sensible wife is more precious than coral or pearls. Or, if you pardon me, you know, just, you know, more precious than physical pleasures that you might get, you know, from a younger woman or whatever. You see the idea? Precious gift. And so, too often, you see, what the point here is that men too easily are looking for the eye candy. And some of the sweetest candy dissolves quickly in the mouth. And it's gone. Some of the other candies last a little longer in the end. Oh, anyway, but the point is that a good, sensible woman, Mary, a good, sensible, it isn't always the prettiest one. Now, I don't mean to diss pretty women either. A lot of great, very beautiful women, like all of you in the room. Sensible, they love the Lord. But I'm just saying, just don't, and it's the same with, you know, with women, and I think women are better at this than men. At least my sense of it is that I know that women can sometimes say, "Ooh, he's," you know, but basically, gotta be careful. We got a young man in the room here, but all right. But generally, women, I think, take stock of a man in a richer way. Generally, my sense. I'm not saying every single individual woman, but my experience is that generally women are able to see a richer tapestry when they're looking at a man rather than just some aspect of his physical characteristics. That may be part of the mix, but it's not the only thing, which is sometimes with a man, it's just about all that's going on in his mind. When he sees her, whoa, you know, say baby, you know. You know, you got the curves, I've got the angles. Anyway, the point is that you can see why this is addressed especially to men, right? Value. All right. But I think that we have to admit as men that eye candies really, we're very visual, and we can be very easily misled by just the visual. And the text is simply saying, a sensible, good wife is more precious than any physical beauty, and gold than any precious coral, or just really value a good wife. And don't run after the young honey who looks a little bit more, you know, men tend to look more at younger women. That's just a fact. I'm sorry. And again, the text is reminding men who in that culture had some freedom to easily divorce their wife not to do that. Okay. All right. So we're done. We're going to end here and pick up again. Now, what we're going to deal with next time, I want to talk to you about when the next time should be in a minute, but respect for human beings and proper parenting and respect for our elders is what takes place in the next section. Okay? Now, let's talk. Let me turn off this recording.